Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network. And today on the show...
But right now, gas corporations in Australia pay barely any tax, and all we're proposing is that they pay a similar rate of tax to that in Norway.
Advocates calling for a 50% tax on gas export from Australia to help reduce rising living costs.
That point that I was making earlier, that, you know, people come to Australia, they want to be able to contribute to our country and to their communities.
Angus Taylor's migration plan is drawing criticism. We speak with Anne Alley. And later today...
So trying to do everything myself. You know, I built the whole thing from scratch and saved about 90% of the costs.
Queensland astronomers making global breakthrough with a distant planet discovery. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Gas giants are set to rack in up to $107 billion exporting Australian gas this year as global conflict sends energy prices soaring. However, critics say Australians are being left behind while corporations cash in. A new report is calling for a massive tax on these weekly profits, arguing billions could be redirected to ease the cost of living crisis. I spoke with Max Chandler Mather from the Green Institute about the findings and the push for action.
Gas corporations in Australia are exceptionally profitable. Over the last few years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine that spiked oil and gas prices, gas corporations have made $289 billion in gas export revenue. And on 50% of the gas that Australia exports, those corporations pay zero state royalties. And we have modelled a 50% tax based on what has done in Norway. They effectively charge a 59% tax on oil and gas exports. And in fact, in Norway, they have very similar costs of production. It's about costs Norwegian gas corporations and oil and gas corporations about 9% of revenue to basically produce the oil and gas and export it overseas. And in Australia, it costs those companies about 11% of total revenue. In other words, they have very similar costs, but right now gas corporations in Australia pay barely any tax, and all we're proposing is that they pay a similar rate of tax to that in Norway. And what that would raise is $55 billion in the first year, up to $55 billion in the first year. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what we could do with that sort of money to help people struggling with the cost of living and the housing crisis.
I guess on that note, how can it help Australians, you know, with the cost of living?
All sorts of ways. I mean, $55 billion, every household in Australia, $5,000. That's just how much money that is. That's over 10 million households in Australia. We could use it to build over 100,000 public homes, wipe all student debt, make university free. And I suppose the critical comparison to make here is that in Norway, as a result of their tax system, they use their oil and gas export revenue effectively to pay for a generous public pension scheme that ensures no pensioner lives in poverty and world-class public and social services. And in Australia, our oil and gas export revenue is used to pay for extra mansions and yachts for gas CEOs. And I'm pretty sure I know which way most Australians would prefer that money to go.
The revenue estimates rely partly on the war-driven price spikes at the moment. How sustainable is the policy if, you know, global gas prices go back to the pre-conflict levels?
Well, that's not going to happen for a long time. So we know that the impacts on the gas price are going to last up to 5 years. And even if gas prices start to decline again, I'm sure those people out there who are a bit worried about the multinational gas corporations that have made hundreds of billions of dollars selling our gas often for free might be worried they might be doing it a bit tough. Rest assured, they'll still make a reasonable rate of return. What I'm really worried worried about, though, is the millions of Australians right now living in poverty, while their gas that they collectively own, as every member of the Australian public is sold overseas, sometimes for nothing, no return for the Australian taxpayer. So, look, they'll be fine. These are big multinational gas corporations. They pay similar rates of tax all around the world. The only difference here in Australia is they have a stranglehold over our political system. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the reason that gas taxes are so low in Australia, the reason that we don't get a fair rate of return, is not because of some technical reason, it's because of politics. Because Santos and Woodside and Chevron donate enormous amounts of money to the Labor and Liberal Party. And previously, Labor ministers have gone on to work for the oil and gas industry. And there's these links between our political class and this oil and gas industry that basically mean that an industry has a stranglehold over our political system. And the only way to break that really is to break the hold that those establishment parties have over our political system, or at the very least put enough public pressure on them that they are forced to concede something.
Max Chandler-Mather from the Green Institute speaking with The Wire. This week, opposition leader Angus Taylor announced a new plan to reduce immigration to Australia, drawing mixed reactions. The proposal includes stricter visa rules, increased scrutiny of social media, and a stronger focus on Australian values. Labor and human rights groups have criticised the plan, calling it a political strategy to win votes. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Anne Ali about her response to the proposal.
Well, I thought it wasn't so much of a policy as it was an ideological and, might I say, negative approach to immigration. Australia has always prided itself on an in-principle, non-discriminatory immigration system, and one that has worked really well comparatively. I noticed that he talked about, you know, extraviting of certain people from certain places, particularly he spoke about, you know, Gazan refugees and extraviting for them. And they've already been vetted. They've been vetted quite thoroughly, actually, before they get here. I thought that his speech was more about really denigrating immigration, I have to say. And I would say to Angus Taylor, you know, I was out there yesterday and I spoke to, for example, a group of African women refugees who spoke so strongly and so passionately about their aspirations and their desires and how grateful they are to be in Australia, their aspirations to set up their own businesses in Australia, to learn new skills, to contribute to this country and in their own words, to give back to Australia. I would say to Angus Taylor, get out there and meet these people before you lump migrants into good and bad based on which country they come from, which language they speak, the colour of their skin or their ethnic origins. Get out there and talk to them. I just find this generalisation and this attempt to lump good and bad migrants and to distinguish good and bad migrants really feeds into a narrative that does a lot of damage to our social harmony, but also that neglects and refuses to recognise the incredible contributions that immigration and migrants have made over the years.
As the Minister of Small Businesses as well, as you mentioned, you've visited businesses and some of them are founded by multicultural Australians. What have they mentioned to you about the petrol prices affecting their businesses, all the issues that are happening outside?
Yeah, so around 34% across the nation of new businesses are started by immigrants, which really demonstrates that point that I was making earlier, that, you know, people come to Australia, they want to be able to contribute to our country and to their communities. And you know, the good news is that in this last quarter, we had a record number of new businesses starting, which indicates that there is more confidence in small businesses. Obviously, reducing the petrol excise and removing the heavy road user charge has had a positive impact on small businesses. That's what they're telling me. They're telling me that that's really helped them. We've also recently introduced a new suite of packages also to assist small businesses around tax system flexibility, around allowing them to access credit more quickly and more efficiently. And they're also getting support from the financial sector and broader support as well. So when I meet with migrant small businesses, there's two things. The first thing is that they are incredibly invested in their communities. They undertake to train people. They are very good at training people and very good at retaining new workers. and they are very, very keen on contributing to our nation.
And speaking about all those things, the federal government has cut the petrol excise for 3 months to support all Australians with the petrol prices. What other initiatives are on the table to support Australians through this time?
So there are two things. So we've got a national plan that was agreed upon by the Prime Minister and all the state premiers. That's a four-phase plan, and we're in phase two of that plan. And the plan is designed to escalate should the situation in the Middle East get worse. The first thing, of course, is that we continue to urge for a sustainable ceasefire and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. But of course, as the Treasurer said this morning, even when that happens, the shock of this will be felt for some time after. So some of the things that we're doing, of course, the petrol excise, as you mentioned. I also mentioned the heavy road user charge. That's on the kind of the price supply. So ensuring that, you know, Australians can access petrol at a cost, at a lower cost. The other side, of course, is the supply side and ensuring that there is petrol and diesel available for Australians. There are a number of things that we've done there. We've released our some of our supplies. You'll note that the Prime Minister is currently in Brunei, but he's done a visit to Singapore and Malaysia, working with our international and regional partners to ensure that we continue to get our supply of fuel from those countries.
Federal Member for Multicultural Anne Alley speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. In South Australia, One Nation has recorded a major result, securing 7 seats in the state parliament. The outcome includes 4 lower house seats, shaking up long-held Liberal strongholds in regional areas. One of the biggest shifts was in the seat of Hammond, home to Murray Bridge, with the results confirmed days after the election. National Radio News' Noah Seckham spoke with Perry Strathern about what this means for South Australian politics.
The big thing about Robert Willis, our new state One Nation MP, is that he's from outside politics. He's a ferry driver from Manham, a 38-year-old ferry driver with no previous council experience, government experience. This is what has simultaneously shocked some people and enthused other people. You know, the folks who perhaps are supporters of the major parties are shocked that this person who has no political or representative background can make it into office. And the people who are doing it tough and who are enraged about the way the world is at present are delighted that someone from outside the establishment is going to be pulling the levers of power for the next 4 years.
You've spoken with him a few times now. What's your insight on him? Do you think that that sort of outside politics nature is going to come through?
It's interesting. On the one hand, you know, you look at his inexperience and, I mean, he's admitted to me that it's going to be a steep learning curve for him. But I think that of the minor party and independent candidates we had at our state election here in Hammond, we had 12 candidates, and there were 3 who I guess were regarded as front runners or, you know, well-established credentialed traditional candidates, Liberal, Labor and an independent. And of the rest of them, I think that the One Nation candidate here is the one who probably had the temperament to make it work, who's really taken it seriously. You know, not all of his views might be shared by everyone in the electorate, even though it is quite a conservative electorate, but he has approached it like it is a job application process and like it's a job that he's interested in doing. And now he's in the job. He's gone from furniture maker by trade, ferry driver most recently, part-time distiller with his brother, and now he's making 220 grand a year as a state MP.
What do you think actually tipped the public over the edge for that to happen? What are the things that people were really taking to the election?
I don't think in this particular electorate of Hammond or in MacKillop, which is a neighbouring electorate that I follow quite closely, neither of these electorates are electorates where the candidate has won people over. The candidate in MacKillop is a former security guard, Mount Gambier councillor who doesn't even live in the electorate and, you know, doesn't have ties to that community. But people have flocked to the party, One Nation. And I say flocked, you know, this has been a seismic shift in South Australian politics, but at the same time, we're talking about a party that got between 20 and 35% of the vote in the seats where they won. It's not like an overwhelming majority of people are on the orange bandwagon just yet. But I think the factor that has got One Nation the success it's had in South Australia has been the national brand recognition, right? When I asked people on social media, why did you vote for Robert Roylands? The big things that came up were people are sick of the major parties. They feel like the current economic system is not working for them. There was a man of the people type thing. You know, he's a regular guy. He's not a political operator. I like that. But there was also a lot of recognition of Pauline Hanson. And there was a lot of recognition of immigration as an issue that people are agitated about because they believe that reducing immigration will solve the housing crisis. That was a real motivating factor for people. And it will be interesting to see whether the people who were most passionate about supporting One Nation at this election, how their attitude evolves over the next few years as it becomes evident that a state party with 4 lower house MPs can't actually do anything about immigration at a federal level. It's going to be an interesting period.
To the former MP of the region, who I believe was in for something about like 20 years, you've also spoken to him recently. What's his takeaway? How does he feel considering what's happened?
Adrian Pedrick is our state MP who's just been booted out after 20 years, and he's been quite accepting of the fact that his term's come to an end. I think he said to me that he saw the writing on the wall before the election. I mean, the fact that our MP has been in for 20 years for 5 terms was another kind of locally specific factor that I think influenced the election here. You know, if you had the Liberal Party running a younger, a new face, maybe people feel like that's enough change for them. But I have a feeling that, you know, the regional electorates where One Nation has done well are the places that have been taken for granted, that Labor has never offered a serious alternative. These are electorates that have been ignored by Labor, been taken for granted by the Liberals, and now all of a sudden they're not going to be taken for granted anymore. So in that respect, hopefully this is a positive outcome.
Perry Strathern speaking with National Radio News' Noah Seckham. Australia's foreign aid funding has dropped to its lowest level in more than 60 years. New polling from YouGov suggests around 80% of taxpayers overestimate how much of the federal budget is spent on aid. In reality, just 0.65% goes toward foreign assistance, placing Australia well behind most OECD countries. National Radio News' Noah Seckham began by asking Australian Council for International Development CEO Matthew Murray about the impact of these figures.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, their Development Assistance Committee, puts out a ranking every year which shows how much countries give as a percentage of their overall economy to international development, international aid. And it's actually sad to see Australia's statistics. We are actually at a point in our history where we have never been lower. We are the least generous to international development and aid than we've ever been in the history of our aid program. So we are going backwards. And the last year we went backwards as well, just in terms of the overall rankings. We recently did, as ACFID, did a survey of the general public, because I think as we go into the budget, it's useful to be able to say to our politicians, what does the Australian public think about how much we give to aid and how much we should give? We did a poll with YouGov, and it replicated a study that gets done over and over again, which shows that people wildly overestimate how much is given to aid. So if you ask the average Australian how much we give to aid, 80% of them think we give more than we do. We're involved in a campaign right now called the Safer World for All campaign. And the framing of that campaign is really around saying we should be committing to 1% of our federal budget, which leaves 99 cents of every dollar we spend for domestic priorities and for us to spend here in Australia, and 1 cent, you know, out of every dollar to go to international issues and being a good global neighbor.
Something that we've heard a lot about is the U.S. aid cuts last year, which caused a massive ripple effect across the world. But what I've seen is that Australia cut our funding substantially years beforehand, but I don't recall that being covered as intensely or scrutinised perhaps as much. What was the impact of that? And can you talk us through any of that sort of context that might be missing from the current debate?
13 years ago, Australia went through its own version of the USAID cuts, where we had a massive cut to our aid program. And so now when we look at where where we are on the global standings, even though last year we didn't cut. So we're one of the few out of the 36 OECD countries, 24 of them cut their how much they give in real terms last year. Australia didn't cut in terms of the dollars it gives, but because the economy is growing and because of inflation, that's one of the reasons we go backwards. But the USAID cuts had a massive global impact. And just on aggregate, again, last year, there was more money pulled out of the overall global development program than in any time in history. Why does that matter? COVID was not that long ago that any of us have forgotten the impacts of COVID. International issues like global health, they don't end at our national borders. I mean, these things, the world is interconnected. A conflict in the Middle East, it impacts Australia. As we know, we're living with those realities. We are part of this global system. We're part of what happens around the world impacts us in Australia. So when we think that we can actually turn inward and not be part of, you know, contributing to the prosperity, the wealth, the peace, the security of the entire world, we actually pay the price as well. So it's a very short-sighted way of thinking of the world and thinking about the part that we play.
For the budget specifically, is there, a feeling that this could be turned around? How do you cut through, I guess?
Look, having worked 35 years in the international development space, I guess to do this as long as I've had, you have to be at somewhat level an optimist and always be thinking about how can we make things better. And the great thing is that if you look over the last 20 years, in just about every way that you measure poverty, the world has gotten better. You know, one of the false narratives is that, you know, we're not actually making progress. We actually are in terms of access to water, education, rights, these sorts of things. The world is actually improving. But as we go into this budget, you know, budgets are always a reflection of national values, and they're always a trade-off of choices. And as I said, part of the reason we did that YouGov polling was just to show that Australians actually, part of our values is to be compassionate, is to care, is to do the right thing. We see it when there's a bushfire. We see how people respond. We see how people, as charities, we see how people give when they see a crisis is happening. So that's part of who we are. And we think our budget should reflect that. And so this is one of those budgets where we'd like to see not only that the aid portion maintained, but actually increased.
Australian Council for International Development CEO Matthew Murray speaking with The Wire. A group of Queensland astronomers have won the Page Medal for discovering a ring across a faraway planet. In his home observatory in suburban Brisbane, Renato Langesac and his colleagues found a distinctive ring in dwarf planet Quawar. Their discovery has been recognised in the astronomy community worldwide. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking amateur astronomer Renato Langesac how he felt on winning the medal.
The Page Medal is the highest recognition you can get as an amateur astronomer in Australia. It's awarded by the Astronomical Society of Australia, which is an association of professional astronomers. My friends Jonathan Bradshaw, John Broughton, and I were stoked, if you ask us how we feel.
Renato, could you please tell us how astronomy has become a passion of yours?
Well, as a five-year-old, I sat in front of the TV watching Neil Armstrong step on the moon. Later, my godfather, he was the head of an astronomy group in Baden bei Wien, which is a small town 25 kilometers south of Vienna. And he influenced me as a teenager and encouraged me to continue this hobby.
Now, I understand you have a small observatory at home. What motivated you to build one, and were there any challenges for you to build it?
Yes, my observatory. Well, to set up my telescope in the backyard, it takes me usually half an hour on a tripod, and then the same to pack it up. If a sudden storm rolls in, you can imagine what happens. I planned the observatory for 10 years and took me 1 year to build it. And now it only takes me seconds to set up or pack away. Challenges, of course, was trying to do everything myself. You know, I built the whole thing from scratch and saved about 90% of the costs. It took me 1 year to build.
We're not astronomers, so you are the expert here. So in terms that we can understand, you found a ring around this planet Quawar. Is that how you pronounce it?
Quawar, yeah.
Quawar, yeah. So how did you manage to see this? And tell us about the discovery.
Well, when an object goes between us and a distant star, we call this an occultation. It casts the star be obstructed by this little dot, and will cast a shadow on Earth. And with specific cameras, you can actually do precise timing when this star disappears and it reappears. So an occultation for Quawa was announced through the circles that we are in. And the three amigos, that's Jonathan, myself, and John, we decided, because we were much too far in the north for the main body event. So what we did is we decided to look for something else, like a secondary event, something like a moon. Now, much earlier than predicted, we saw a blip. Each of us saw this blip for a fraction of a second. And after we analyzed the data, we realized that the blips lined up to form a triangle, which pointed at an arc. So it wasn't one object, it would have been an arc. So we recorded this to the professionals, and Bruno Mogada from the Lucky Star Project, which is funded by universities, and they had a control for the main event. And he wrote a paper how the ring was outside the Roche limit. The Roche limit defines the distance of the planetoid ring and how far it has to be to exist. So this one doesn't fit in. So he published a paper in the prestigious scientific publication called Nature, which was followed by more than 100 other papers. So there was quite a bit of work happening in the background after that.
Now, how relevant is this discovery in the astronomy community? And what's your next work now in amateur astronomy?
We were self-funded astronomers. We discovered it without any financial support by big institutions. We buy our equipment all ourselves. And the other thing was, we caused an avalanche of research work in the professional world. If I look in the future, I'll probably continue doing my occultation work, and I'll probably try to image my asteroid that was named after me.
Amateur astronomer and winner of Page Medal Renato Langasak, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations, SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time, on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire, independent current affairs on radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.